Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. Struggle over the legality of abortion has roiled the country for more than 50 years. On one side, the pro-life movement insists that innocent life must be protected by the government and in morality from conception to natural death. On the other, self-described pro-choice advocates insist that abortion is medical care and that the decision of whether to terminate a pregnancy belongs solely to the mother and her doctor. Few issues have so bitterly divided the country, and for as long, with the possible exception of abolition and the civil rights movements. Pro-life advocates are often stereotyped as being merely pro-birth, that is, only caring for a baby until he or she is born. But is that true? And what drives committed pro-life advocates to expend so much time and energy in furtherance of the cause? My guest today is such a committed activist. Dr. Michael J. New is an assistant professor of practice at the Catholic University of America, a senior associate scholar at the Charlotte Lozier Institute, and a Paige Comstock Cunningham Senior Fellow at Americans United for Life. A Phi Beta Kappa graduate from Dartmouth College, Dr. New received a master's degree in statistics and a doctorate in political science from Stanford University in 2002. Dr. New researches and writes about the social science of sanctity of life issues. He gives presentations on both the positive impact of pro-life laws and the long-term gains in public support for the pro-life position. He has been a guest on both EWTN News Nightly and CNN International. He appears frequently on Catholic radio and is a frequent blogger on National Review Online's The Corner. Michael, welcome to Humanize.
Thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
You're an academic. What inspired you to choose that career?
I went to academia partly because I was just trying to run away from the real world for as long as I could. Undergraduate, I went to Dartmouth. There was a very strong corp recruiting scene at Dartmouth, and I had some friends of mine who were, very interested in getting jobs and internships at consulting firms or investment banks. But the internships they got, they didn't enjoy. They didn't seem very happy working for these places. I thought, life is, pretty short, and, you should try to, if you can, try to do something you might actually enjoy. So I wasn't really interested in joining the whole corp recruiting rat race. I love politics and policy, but I was not that intrigued by going to the Beltway. If you show up in Washington, D.C., as a recent college graduate, you're going to get entry-level work that probably doesn't pay real well. And honestly, I didn't go to Dartmouth and earn the kind of grades I did to show up in D.C. and push a mail cart around. I love the political science classes I took. I applied to grad school, and I was very lucky. Stanford let me into their PhD program, one of the best things ever happened to me in the course of my life. So at the ripe old age of 21, I embarked on this PhD, got through the program, got a postdoc at Harvard after I wrapped up at Stanford, got a tenure track at University of Alabama after that, and found myself as a full-time professor. So a lot of it was just trying to avoid the real world and discovered that I had a talent for teaching and writing and research and stayed with it.
Your teaching at Catholic University is not part of the pro-life activism, is it?
Not directly. I mean, I teach economics here, so I teach classes in microeconomics, macroeconomics. I teach a class on the federal budget, and I teach game theory. With a budget class, we do sometimes talk a little bit about the Hyde Amendment. But being, a professor means you get to mentor and work with students. So even though I'm not really teaching about sanctity of life issues day to day, there are kids who are interested in pro-life issues, but you get to work with, who I can let know about different opportunities. I mean, it is all kind of part of my job.
And what is the Charlotte Lozier Institute?
The Charlotte Lozier Institute is the research and education arm of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America. For a long time, the only large group doing research on abortion issues was the Guttmacher Institute, which up until 2006 or 2007 was the research arm of Planned Parenthood. And they've always had a very strong pro-abortion, pro-contraception bias. And pro-lifers just needed their own think tank to kind of organize Reagan research, to, you know, get op-ed submitted to newspapers, to arrange for pro-life people to testify from Congress to state legislatures. And the Institute launched around 2011, 2012. I was very honored. I was the actually first associate scholar they put on board. So Lozier at one point was three people. It was me, who was our president, Chuck Donovan, and Chuck's assistant, Dora Sullivan. Now we're much bigger. We have about 40 or 50 associate scholars, cover a very wide range of issues, theology, philosophy, public health, bioethics, social science. So I've been a real force for good and very honored to be part of the Lozier team.
I want to make sure that people understand that when you talk about the scholarship at Charlotte Lozier, you are coming from a pro-life perspective, but you don't skew the data, do you?
No, we look at research questions that are of interest to other pro-lifers. So, you know, I try to, you know, do analytically rigorous research. You know, I do publish things in, you know, mainstream academic journals that, you know, are not pro-life. You know, one thing I always say, if the data back you up, you will win. It may take a long time, but the truth does win out in the end. So I do research things that are of interest to pro-lifers, like impact of pro-life laws and public opinion trends on abortion, but I don't really skew data. You know, I try to report things, you know, honestly and try to be an honest broker with the data that's publicly available.
And what got you so interested in the pro-life movement? I mean, you've got a full-time job as a professor, and it's almost like you have a second full-time, let's say, avocation as a pro-life activist.
It's kind of interesting. Several things have always kind of drawn me to the pro-life movement. I mean, when I was growing up, you know, I went to a Catholic grade school, Catholic high school. Abortion was not really on the radar screen for me. I was scrambling around, trying to get good grades, trying to get myself into a good school. I remember in 11th grade, again, went to a Catholic high school. I did get to see the movie The Silent Scream, and, you know, which, if your viewers don't recall, that was a movie that came out in the mid-1980s. It was narrated by Dr. Bernard Nathanson, who at one time was an abortion doctor. In fact, probably performed more abortions than just about anybody. Had a conversion, became pro-life, and was able to film an ultrasound of an abortion taking place. And it's very vivid, very graphic. And it was very moving for, I think, a lot of pro-lifers of kind of my generation. And I saw the movie, and I was kind of disgusted by it, but I still wasn't motivated. You know, I thought abortion was a crummy thing in a world full of crummy things, and went about my day. And then I go to Dartmouth for undergrad. I had kind of a tough freshman year. The only thing I really enjoyed my freshman year about Dartmouth were some of the conservative political groups I got involved with. And that started moving me down more of a pro-life path. And at some point freshman year, I would have been comfortable, you know, identifying myself as someone who was pro-life. And then sophomore year, I don't remember what happened exactly, but this is, you know, the outline. I just remember going to Catholic Mass one day, and I don't think the sermon was anything, had anything to do about abortion, but something gave me like a ton of bricks, that abortion is a really important issue. This is not like kind of the capital gains tax or term limits or the idea of the week. Abortion is really important, and I just felt I should be doing something. Well, I'm a sophomore, 18, 19 years old. What can I do? Yep, start a campus group, maybe. So I approached my priest. I said, I'd like to start a pro-life group. He told me his student's already working on it. I emailed the student. We got together, launched a group, and I never looked back. So God just kind of reached out and grabbed me.
So it sounds like it was rose out of your Catholic faith, but wasn't because of your Catholic faith.
Yeah, I think my Catholic faith has always kind of informed, you know, my views, but I've always been impressed by the secular arguments. I mean, I think we have very strong apologetics. I think, you know, a very strong non-religious case can be made for the pro-life position. You know, I think everyone should be pro-life, whether you're Christian, a non-Christian, atheist. I think the arguments are very strong, very solid, and I think should appeal to everybody.
Well, that's where I was going to go next. What are just, let's say, three of the quote-unquote secular pro-life arguments?
Well, the first and main one is that, you know, every biology textbook teaches very clear that life begins at conception. Regardless of your theological views, biology textbooks agree that that is when, you know, the sperm and the egg meet, that is a new, unique, distinct human being. If life begins at conception, life should be protected. I mean, that just is the, you know, the most straightforward argument that doesn't involve religion at all, involves science and what biology textbooks teach us. And There was an individual about, 10, 12 years ago who surveyed academic biologists who have PhDs, and these aren't individuals who necessarily are Christian or teaching Christian schools. And overwhelming majority of these academic biologists agreed that, again, life does in fact begin at conception.
But a lot of people know that or pretend they don't know that and still are in favor of it being legal. What about the idea that unborn life isn't conscious yet, so it doesn't have the same moral status as the mother?
I mean, first off, I think that, you have to realize that some people don't believe that, the preborn deserve, legal protection. So they may say that they're human beings, but not persons. And I'll just say, we've gotten a lot of trouble with society when we've decided that certain human beings weren't persons. In this country, we decided that, African Americans at one point weren't persons and they were enslaved. Hitler decided that Jews weren't persons. They were summarily, executed in large numbers. So I think that's a very dangerous path to go down. You want to include everybody, you not draw certain lines and exclude people. The argument that the unborn, aren't completely conscious, don't have awareness, that leads you to all kinds of bad places. People with advanced stages of dementia don't really have awareness the way the rest of us do. Newborns don't have awareness or consciousness the way some of us do. People in a coma don't have consciousness the way the rest of us do. But I really don't think we should go around killing people with Alzheimer's, people in comas, or newborns. So just the fact that people don't have the same level of cognitive development that others do don't mean that they have any less value as a person. Everyone deserves protection.
So my good friend Nat Hentoff, the late, great Nat Hentoff, was an atheist. And he agreed with you. He became pro-life at a great, by the way, cost to his career, precisely for the reason you just stated, that if you're going to have universal human rights, it has to apply to all humans. So he was a stalwart in that regard, and he certainly didn't come at it from religion.
No, Nat was a very principled guy. I mean, he was, by and large, had liberal views on a lot of issues, but on the life issues, he was very solid. I mean, I thought he was, a very principled guy, made good kind of rigorous arguments that I think, would appeal to, a non-religious audience, and he was a very good advocate for our side, so he's someone I did respect.
About how many abortions have been performed in the United States since Roe v. Wade, which was 1973, right?
I don't know the exact figure at my fingertips. It's probably been over 60 million. It's been quite a lot.
Are you saying 6 million or 6
no, 60, million? 60, 60 million.
60 million babies have been terminated approximately since Roe v. Wade.
Yes.
And that's in the United States alone?
Just the U.S. alone.
And approximately how many abortions occur in the United States annually?
It's a little bit hard to say right now because, sadly, a lot of abortions are taking place by telehealth, and I kind of question how reliable some of those numbers are. But based on the estimates we have, I think roughly 1.1 million abortions take place every year based on the data that I see.
And with regard to telehealth, I was going to bring this up later, but we might as well do it now. You have a surgical abortion, which is the classic idea of the woman going into the abortionist and having the baby terminated, versus what some call medical abortion or some call chemical abortion, where pills are taken at home earlier in the pregnancy. And those are the two primary forms of abortion. Is that right?
That's correct.
And so you're saying that, I guess, are there reporting requirements in terms of surgical abortions that are supposed to be made?
That's a good question. I mean, the Center for Disease Control does try to collect data on surgical abortions. But the problem is report requirements are very weak. And some states don't report data. California has not reported data to the CDC since 1997. So data we get from the CDC is not complete.
Does the 60 million include estimates for the non-reported abortions or just the reported abortions?
That's just reported. Reported does include chemical and surgical.
Okay.
What concerns me about numbers today is that some chemical abortions are done by telehealth, where women go online and get pills that, frankly, might be sent from another country. And, there are researchers who do try to track this, but I question how accurate some of the numbers are. I mean, I think some of the places that do telehealth abortions may want to inflate their own numbers a bit to make this look kind of commonplace. Just because a chemical abortion pill was ordered doesn't mean the abortion actually happened. I mean, some women may change their mind. There is some evidence some women do order these chemical abortion pills for future use. So I think we have an idea of what's happening, but we just don't have precise numbers.
I thought that the abortion pill, to use one of a better term, that the woman was supposed to be under the immediate care of a physician.
No. Unfortunately, during the pandemic, the policy was changed. That essentially, a woman has to go online and has to interface with a physician online, but that physician can still prescribe chemical abortions and send the pills to the mail. So prior to the COVID pandemic, a woman seeking a chemical abortion had to at least have an in-person exam with a medical doctor. Post-pandemic, that changed. Go online, have an online appointment through Zoom or Skype or some other online interface, and a doctor can go ahead and prescribe these chemical abortion pills and have them mailed. So you have a lot of abortions that take place without medical supervision. The Biden administration conceded this policy post-pandemic, and tragically, the Trump administration conceded this policy. They could change it tomorrow if they wanted to, but they have not.
What if the woman has an ectopic pregnancy or isn't pregnant and takes these drugs? What happens? Isn't that dangerous?
I agree. I think it's, you know, obviously fatal for unborn children, but I think it's terrible public health. I mean, if a woman has an ectopic pregnancy and obtains a chemical abortion, that can be fatal. If she's even further along in gestation, she realizes, and obtains a chemical abortion, that can have some very serious negative health consequences. So I think this is just terrible public health. And we have stories about, you know, men who have ordered chemical abortion pills and secretly put them in the drinks or their food of their partner, and the women obtain abortions without wanting one. Again, this is the Wild West. And again, you know, the Trump administration has, within its power, can do things about this. And sadly, they're not conducting some kind of a study to review the safety and efficacy. They don't need to do that. They could put the clamps on this tomorrow if they wanted to.
What is the state of law in other countries, particularly in the West? I have been told that actually the United States has some of the more radical abortion licenses versus other countries. Is that true?
In many respects, yes. I mean, you know, after the Dobbs decision, some states have protected preborn children. But in many European countries, you know, abortion after the second trimester is illegal. You know, they do have gestational limits in place. I'm not an expert, but I think that, you know, many countries do put limits on chemical abortions. I think, you know, Britain has kind of scaled back the ability of women to order these chemical abortion pills online. So in many respects, you know, we do have a much more permissive policy than many other industrialized countries.
Just to be clear, in terms of a pro-life worldview, it doesn't matter whether the unborn child is 3 weeks in gestation or 6 months, correct?
I mean, no, I believe that, you know, all, you know, life is precious and a gift from God, and everyone deserves protected. But I do think that, you know, incremental laws do some good. And if you could protect some preborn children, it's worth doing. You know, my goal is to have, you know, protection for all. But a policy where, you know, some are protected is better than one where none are protected. So I think incremental steps can be useful. I think we made some good incremental progress before Dobbs. Laws like, you know, waiting periods, informed consent laws, parental consent laws, they did a little bit of good. And I think sometimes incremental victories pave the way for larger, bigger victories. You know, we saw that with civil rights. We saw that with other issues as well.
So Dobbs overturned Roe v. Wade. Took about 50 years. Why do you think there was such an explosive reaction in many parts of the country against the Dobbs decision?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that, you know, there were just some people who just thought that, you know, abortion would be legal for, you know, a long time, and were just very surprised to see the Supreme Court make the decision that they did. I don't think a lot of people realize what a bad decision Roe v. Wade was on its merits. It's not constitutional. I mean, there's nothing, the Constitution fundamentally is silent on the issue of abortion. It was judicial activism. It was, as was described, you know, raw judicial power. You know, I think that there's a lot of people out there, you know, engaging in a lot of, frankly, reckless sexual activity who expect of abortion as a backdrop if, in fact, their contraception does fail. And, you know, they were upset that, you know, in fact, they may have to deal with the consequences of their own activities. So I think there are a lot of reasons.
It's very interesting because I was in law school when Roe v. Wade was decided, and it wasn't treated as anything really extraordinary, just kind of along the lines of more liberal decisions that have been going on for a couple of decades. But it really did change the country in a fundamental way, its morals, didn't it?
Things. I mean, I think that the Supreme Court kind of thought at the time, thought that Roe v. Wade would be handled by the general public the way some of the previous decisions on contraceptives were. That the Supreme Court made decisions, you know, starting with Griswold, that expanded the ability of people to take contraceptives. And most Americans just made their peace with the world where contraceptives were readily available. A lot of Americans did not make their peace with abortion. You know, they saw this as something fundamentally different, and it did provoke a long-sustained public backlash. So Supreme Court, I think, really kind of, you know, misread public opinion and misread what would happen in the future. So I think there's certainly that. And really, it did change things for the worse. I think that, you know, legalization of abortion did create a more promiscuous society. I think it allowed for, frankly, more sexual risk-taking. I think it made it much easier for men to simply walk away from women they impregnated. You know, I think the culture has become a lot more coarse, a lot more harsh, a lot less sympathetic to women. And I think it's had a lot of very strong, you know, negative impacts on society.
Feminists and others have said quite to the opposite. That is, this is an empowerment for women, and that without the right to an abortion, they would never attain a full equality in the public square with men. What do you think of that argument?
I think that's a bad argument. I think that there's been research looking at how women have made gains economically, professionally, et cetera. Most of the studies really don't consider abortion as a main factor in the fact that women are doing better in terms of their economic status and being more likely to obtain, you know, graduate degrees making other professional achievements. And also, one thing I always tell people is that, you know, abortion numbers have gone down long term. You know, the abortion rate peaked in 1980. And between 1980 and about 2017, the U.S. abortion rate fell in half. While the abortion rate is falling, women have done better and better. You know, women are now a majority of undergraduate students in college. You know, women are earning a larger and larger share of master's degrees and PhDs. So it really doesn't seem that, you know, abortion's been, you know, a big factor in that. Abortion numbers are falling during a time when women's kind of professional and economic status is increasing. So I don't really think abortion has much to do with the fact that women, again, are doing, you know, better as a group, either professionally, occasionally, or economically.
Post-Dobbs, the issue has basically been thrown back into the state legislatures, and we've seen really varied results depending on the state. Texas, for example, has what's known as a heartbeat law, which seeks to reduce abortion. Describe that law and the impact it has had.
Sure. I mean, this was interesting. Texas actually succeeded in getting a Heartbeat Act enforced prior to Dobbs. Some folks forget that. They had a law, the heartbeat law, that protected preborn children after a fetal heartbeat could be detected, which is roughly 6 weeks gestation. I don't want to get into all the legal technicalities, but they drafted the law in such a way that made it very hard for that law to be challenged in court. So that law actually took effect September 1st, 2021, which was about 6-7 months before Dobbs. So Texas was actually protecting the preborn even before Dobbs. So after the Dobbs decision, you know, they went even further. They passed legislation that kind of protected all preborn children. But the heartbeat law has done a lot of good. It was the first time a state really was able to protect the preborn, you know, after a certain stage of gestation. And there's been a lot of good research showing it has saved lives. I did a study with Lozier. There's been two other studies have come out, which have looked at birth data. And we found that roughly 6-7 months after the Heartbeat Act took effect, the number of babies being born in Texas went up. And my analysis and the other analyses all show the Heartbeat Act has saved over 1,000 babies every month in Texas. So, you know, in this post-Dobbs world, counting abortions is hard. Women go to other states or other countries or order pills through the mail. So counting abortions is hard, but counting babies is easy. You know, the government doesn't do a real whole lot well, but babies are hard to miss. You know, they cry, they crawl around, they make noise, and birth data is pretty accurate. And if you see more babies being born after a pro-life law is passed, there's good statistical evidence the law is having some impact.
Correlation isn't necessarily causation, but you believe there is a connection.
Well, again, when you really see the numbers kind of jump up 6-7 months after the law is passed, there's pretty good evidence. Yeah, and also, not only do we have, you know, timing, we also have data on geography. And again, I did a study for this, which I'm going to try to get published pretty soon, that, you know, in Texas, you know, women could still obtain abortions, but then they go to other states. So a woman lived in, say, El Paso, that's close to New Mexico. So the Texas Heartbeat Act, you know, wasn't necessarily a barrier to her. If a woman lived in like Austin or in the central part of the state, getting to another state, you know, was tricky in terms of time spent and cost. So you saw like bigger birth increases in those parts of Texas that were like far away from like out-of-state abortion facilities. So you really did see that, you know, again, in those Texas cities that were far away from out-of-state facilities, birth numbers really did go up after the Heartbeat Act took effect.
In contrast, you had a lot of what are sometimes called blue states passing laws to expand access to abortion all the way through pregnancy. Did you see the same kind of increase in abortions when these laws were expanded?
Well, you did see an increase in blue states, but I think a lot of that increase was just due to out-of-state women going to other states to obtain abortions. I mean, laws do a lot of good, but they're not magical. I mean, laws can be circumvented. Tragically, a lot of women in conservative states, since the pro-life laws, traveled to more politically liberal states to obtain abortions. Numbers have gone up, but largely due to kind of women coming in from other states. One development that's been, you know, sad and tragic is that, you know, the Democratic Party really has become a lot more politically liberal on abortion. And in many states, they're now covering abortion through the state Medicaid program. It's 2017, Illinois, Rhode Island, Maine, Delaware, Nevada. These states are all covering abortion through the state Medicaid program. And there's just a big body of evidence that shows that when states cover abortion through Medicaid, abortion numbers go up. Sadly, in these states, the Medicaid coverage is pushing abortion numbers up, and that's tragic.
I was going to bring up Hyde a little bit later, but since you mentioned it, the idea of Medicaid and abortion, the Hyde Amendment, which has to be passed annually, prevents federal money from being used for abortion in Medicaid, but not state, correct?
Right. The federal government places a limit. It's not necessarily a ban, but it's a strong limit. There are some circumstances where federal Medicaid money can be used, but they're very limited to scenarios of like rape and incest. So it basically limits the ability of federal taxpayer dollars to fund abortion through Medicaid. But states, if they want to, can use their own taxpayer dollars to fund abortion through their own Medicaid programs. Sadly, about 22 or 23 states do so. You know, these are politically liberal states like California, Maryland, where I live, Massachusetts. You know, these are all states, sadly, use their own taxpayer dollars to fund abortion through Medicaid.
The Hyde Amendment was always one of the few examples of compromise, if you will, between the pro-life and the pro-choice political forces. That is, it didn't affect the legality of abortion, but it did make it so that most pro-lifers and everyone else wouldn't have to have their personal tax money pay for it. And that compromise seems to be breaking down. What's the current status of the argument over Hyde?
It's interesting. The Democratic Party has become a lot more hostile to the Hyde Amendment. You know, I think that philosophically, the Democratic Party, you know, in recent years has supported legal abortion. But I think for political reasons, it was a fight that funding abortion was a fight they didn't want to pick with us. President Clinton was elected in 1992, took office in 1993. He made one run at trying to end the Hyde Amendment, which failed. Like, 7 of his 8 budgets include the Hyde Amendment. President Obama is elected in 2008, takes office in 2009. All 8 of President Obama's budgets include the Hyde Amendment. You know, funding abortion was just not a fight they wanted to pick. You know, they realized that taxpayer funding for abortion, especially elective abortions, are unpopular. So for a long time, the Democratic Party just did not want to have this fight with us. That's changed. I mean, the Democratic Party's become a lot more secular, people a lot more liberal. You know, a generation of older Democrats who came of age during, you know, the Great Depression, World War II, that were fairly conservative on social issues, they've largely passed away. They've been replaced by younger people, again, are more liberal, more secular. And, you know, by and large, you do see most Democratic elected officials not only supporting legal abortion, but opposing the Hyde Amendment. So they want abortion to be legal and funded with taxpayer dollars. The Democratic Party has just shifted. You know, you even saw Joe Biden, you know, mostly supporting the Hyde Amendment during his time as a senator. And when he ran for president, first in 2020, you saw him change his tune. So it's unfortunate that we can't work with Democrats on this issue anymore.
So is there any pro-life Democrat around in Congress anymore?
Unfortunately, the last really person we could count on was Dan Lipinski, and he was defeated. You know, he was primaried by somebody who supported legal abortion, and frankly, the Democratic Party didn't really do that much to help Dan Lipinski. They usually help out incumbents, and I think that whatever help they gave him was largely perfunctory. The only Democrat who sometimes will vote our way is Henry Cuellar, who represents a fairly conservative district in rural Texas. Sometimes he's willing to work with us on some incremental things, but he's probably the only one.
It seems to me, as I just observed this, that the Democrat Party, or let's just say the pro-choice movement, used to talk about safe, legal, and rare, which they don't anymore. It's almost like they celebrate abortion as something that is really positive instead of a tragedy. Are you noticing that?
Absolutely. I mean, President Clinton, again, you know, when he ran for president, he said abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. Even President Obama expressed some interest, at least rhetorically, in getting abortion numbers down. Again, I think that the Democratic Party has changed. I think that, you know, there's at one point, there was always a contingent, you know, of Democrats who were part of the New Deal coalition, or people who study political science. Remember that there was kind of a contingency of union members, Catholics, African-Americans, Hispanics, immigrants that were a pretty potent political coalition for Democrats. A lot of the people in that group, you know, were pro-life, or at least were fairly moderate on abortion. the new old New Deal coalition is kind of faded again. These older Democrats who came of age during the Great Depression, came of age during World War II, you know, if they're still alive, they're in their 90s now. Many of them passed away. You know, the Democratic Party these days is a lot more liberal, a lot more secular. And again, you know, primary voters have a lot of influence over who gets nominated. They have a lot of influence over positions the parties take. So Democratic Party sadly really has moved to the left on this issue.
What about the Republican Party? Has it become a primarily pro-life party or is it a mixed bag?
It's become a more pro-life party. I mean, I think just over time, pro-life candidates have just fared better and won primaries. You know, I think that, you know, at one point, some people were involved in the Republican Party largely because they liked the party's stances on budget and fiscal policy and economic issues. But over time, if you were interested in the sanctity of life issues, the Republican Party was just a lot more welcoming, a lot more supportive. So over time, you know, the group of Republicans who support legal abortion either retired or were defeated. Pretty much, you know, just about every Republican congressman is fairly sympathetic on life issues. So the group Republicans for Choice even shut down a few years ago.
So it's actually part of our country's increasing divisions. You know, it's almost like there's a no man's land in the middle, and both political parties have, over various issues, almost incompatible views.
I think that that's true. I mean, I think that parties have polarized. I think there's a variety of reasons for that. You know, part of it is, you know, the internet, and people can get, you know, read news from news outlets that kind of support their own ideological views. Cable news, you know, people can tune on to cable news stations and again, you know, have a spin or a bias that kind of supports their own, you know, ideological views. We become more sophisticated in how to draw congressional districts. There's a lot more kind of safe districts, and you know, the people in these safe districts can count on re-election. They don't have to worry about, you know, reaching out to members of the other party. You know, they just know that if they keep their own constituents happy, their own party happy, they'll be re-elected. So there's a lot of things that led to kind of a lot of polarization when it comes to politics in this country.
One of the reasons I wanted you on the show is that I know that you engage in something called sidewalk counseling in front of a Planned Parenthood. I think you go once a week. What is sidewalk counseling and why do you spend that kind of effort, which is, you know, a real commitment to that activity?
Well, what sidewalk counselors are trying to do is we're trying to make a last-ditch effort to approach abortion-minded women and their partners to not go through with the abortion. We let them know there is help available, that Washington, D.C., like other cities, there are pro-life pregnancy help centers that offer a range of services to women who want to carry pregnancies to term. That can include a maternity home, that include financial help, medical health, counseling. You know, there are options, alternatives available. If a woman wants to carry a pregnancy to term in this country, you know, people will help them. So we're trying to make a last-ditch effort, you know, intercept these women, try to let them know there is help available, let them know they're having second thoughts, you know, we can help. So it is kind of a last-ditch effort to persuade women not to obtain abortions, and also pray, you know, that, you know, we do want to show some solidarity with the pre-born children that will perish. Somebody did care about them. Somebody did love them. Somebody did make a last-ditch effort on their behalf to try to save them. Even when we don't succeed, I think we do give some dignity and some respect to those pre-born children that do perish in those abortion mills that we go to. So I go to the D.C. Planned Parenthood every Saturday morning. I try to punch in by 8:30. I leave by about noon. I just think street-level activism is important. I mean, I do a lot of writing and research, and that's great, but we're not going to witness flying a desk. Something that's important to be there where things are happening. And that's one reason why I go. Secondly, I'm very lucky in many respects. I will tell anyone who listens to me, I have one of the best jobs in the pro-life movement, if not the best job. I get to do things I enjoy. I get to write. I get to research. I get to be on fun podcasts like this. I get to be on the radio. Once in a while, I get to be on TV. All these jobs are fun and pleasant and rewarding. But building a culture of life isn't always fun, pleasant, or rewarding. Sometimes it's tough. And parking myself on the Planned Parenthood for a few hours on Saturday, frankly, is not always fun or pleasant or rewarding. This past Saturday, it rained on us for 3 straight hours. Most passerbys are not receptive. Our batting average isn't great all the time. Some people just ignore us. But it's important to do. So I just think it's important to kind of get my hands dirty in a bit, you know, do something that's tough, do something a little bit out of my comfort zone. Again, you know, building a culture of life, you know, it's going to require a lot of effort from a lot of people. And if I can encourage some folks to do what I do and spend some time in front of those facilities, lives will be saved.
So you use the term intercept. That's not the same thing as harass, is it?
No, I don't view it as harassment. I try to be a good Christian presence out there. You know, I have, you know, literature and resource, local pregnancy centers. I greet people warmly. You know, I tell them, you know, I know it might be a rotten day for you and that, you know, this is, you know, you might be in a difficult situation. But if you're having second thoughts, there's help available. You know, if you want to carry this pregnancy a term, you know, I can help. There are nonprofits in the D.C. area. They have great resources that will help you. You know, I'm not there to scream at people or fight with people or argue with people. I try to be respectful of women and their partners and let them know there's an alternative. They may choose to ignore me. You know, they have free will. And, you know, it's disappointing when I see them walk behind the clinic doors. But, you know, I do myself to be a, you know, a good Christian presence out there. And I just, again, try to peacefully, prayerfully offer alternatives. And that's what me and my team try to do.
But how many people do you think, on average, I know it'll vary, will turn out to be with you in this endeavor on a weekly basis?
That's hard to say. I would say on most, you know, Saturdays, we probably get about, as far as people who are there, you know, to pray in sidewalk console, about 8 to 10 people typically join me. You know, everyone stays the whole morning, but, you know, God uses everybody who comes. 8 to 10 is usually a pretty good number. The Catholic University of America students come, and around 10:30, they do a rosary and a Divine Mercy chaplet. And there can be about 50 or 60 of them. And that's a blessing when they come. But as far as people actually staying for a chunk of the morning to pray or sidewalk console, about 8 to 10.
So aren't there buffer zones around abortion clinics that you can't enter?
In D.C., no. The sidewalk is part of the public right-of-way. We can go up to the steps of that Planned Parenthood. We can't go on their property. That's trespassing. But the sidewalk is part of the public right-of-way. We have every right to be there, you know, just like anybody else. If we want to stay in front of that sidewalk, pray, and offer pro-life literature, we have every right to be there.
And I'd like to hear a story of, let's say, a success story, if you have one, and what happened.
I've lots of, you know, some good success stories. I'll tell you kind of one of my favorite ones. There's a woman named Joan McKee who comes and often prays. And she'll see across the street from the Planned Parenthood and pray. Honestly, most people just ignore her or make fun of her, but she's very faithful. She stands there and she prays. And one day we're out there, it's a little bit late in the morning, and a car comes along and they see Joan. And they pull over and they want to know where to park. And Joan starts a conversation with them. But Joan doesn't usually have literature on her. So as she's engaging with this couple, I run across the street. I look in the car and the woman inside the car says, I already have 5 kids. And I said, all right, the 6th, you just as much fun as the first 5. She starts laughing. I hand her a pamphlet. And then there's a nun with us. And the nun runs across the street. And the nun notices kind of a picture of the Virgin Mary in the car. So this family's Catholic. She's talking about Mary and just says, you know, if God bless you with a kid, you know, he will take care of you. And this is a blessing and something you should look forward to. And, you know, we gave them some literature and the car drove away. I'm pretty sure they never came back. And the reason why I like that story is because, again, if Joan was out there praying, maybe the car just drives by and the clinic escorts get there first, you know, who knows what happens? Because just Joan showed up and prayed, he was able to start a conversation with that couple that I think did result in a child's life being saved. So that's one of my favorite stories.
Have you ever been introduced to a child that might, not necessarily through your sidewalk counseling, but was planned for an abortion and then because of pro-life intervention, the mother changed her mind? Have you ever met children like that?
Yeah, I've met children like that. In fact, there was actually a woman who texted me a picture of her child that, you know, I remember there was one day I was at the clinic and, you know, doing my thing and a friend of mine says, hey, Michael, I don't know if you noticed, but there's a car parked around the corner and there's a woman just crying her eyes out. Okay. So I go up to this car. I see the woman. She does take literature, but she's just very upset, crying, and, you know, doesn't really want to talk. And I'm just keeping an eye on it. Then she finally gets out of the car. She walks to the clinic and, you know, I say, look, clearly you don't want to be here. Why don't we get her some help? And unfortunately, a clinic escort comes along and grabs her and whisks her to the clinic. And then I'm doing my thing, and then the door opens, and someone runs out. And my friend's like, Michael, it's that girl. She just ran out the door. So I basically chased her down the street, like, wait, we can help you. And she talked to me, took some literature. We stayed in touch. And, you know, she sent me a picture of the child she carried at term. So that was great when that showed up in my text feed.
So, that must have touched your heart quite a bit.
Yep. So, you know, again, I was glad I was there that day. Glad I could put her in some touch with some people could help her. So, you know, there are people walk around today whose lives are saved because you get someone rolled out of bed and show up at the abortion clinic and offer some help to a woman in need.
Do you have such an emotional issue, particularly around an abortion clinic? Have you had hostile reactions to you?
Yeah, I mean, Washington, D.C., the neighborhood we saw a concert went, the people there are not terribly receptive to us. But, you know, I'm not concerned about that. You know, I can't control what other people do. I control what I do. You know, we just try to be a good, you know, witness out there. If somebody wants to have a conversation with me and, you know, they're just not trying to distract me or upset me, you know, I will engage in some conversations with passersby, but you know, my main goal is to pray in the sidewalk constantly out there. And you know, sometimes, you know, it's interesting. You know, we sometimes have more support than we realize. I know that a few years ago I was out there with a friend of mine, and somebody kind of flags on my partner and just says, "Listen, I just want you to know something. You have more support in this neighborhood than you realize. There's people here who pray for you and root for you every day. They don't say anything to you. They don't be outed. They don't want their friends to, you know, criticize them or blame them. There are people out there who pray for you and root for you every day. Don't forget that. Keep doing what you're doing." Sometimes people, you know, may be supportive, but just not may want to vocalize that. So we just do our best.
What is the purpose of asking women to get ultrasounds when they're pregnant before having an abortion?
There's very good data that if a woman sees the ultrasound of a preborn child, she's very likely to carry that pregnancy to term. That, you know, ultrasound technology has gotten a lot better. Very often the first picture somebody has of a brother or sister, son, daughter, niece, nephews in utero. And we have very good data from our friends in the Pregnancy Help Center movement that if a woman sees an ultrasound, it's a good image, she's very likely to carry that pregnancy to term.
You're talking about pregnancy help centers. Describe those. I've done a show with a couple of years ago with one of the leaders of that movement, but some of our listeners might not have heard that show. Tell us a little bit about what these centers do, their purpose, and how much they charge the women that they help.
Sure. Well, there's about 2,700 pro-life pregnancy help centers. They offer a range of services to women who want to carry pregnancies to term. That can include summer maternity homes. It can even, you know, put women up and house them. They offer counseling. They offer parenting classes. They offer medical help. Many of them do have licensed physicians and nurses on staff who can, provide medical assistance to women who need it. So they offer a wide range of services. Again, there's about 2,700 of them. They're in every state, every city. Whenever I do a show like this, I always tell listeners, identify a pregnancy help center and do something to help them. You know, they're on the front lines every day helping real women with, you know, in real need. They don't often have big budgets. They're pretty efficient, pretty economical with how they spend money. In most cases, they rely on, you know, the donations of, you know, like-minded people, and they don't charge. You know, all their services are free. You know, whether it's a pregnancy test, whether it's healthcare, you know, they're there to serve women in need, and by and large, their services are free. So, you know, they're a group that deserves the support of pro-lifers everywhere.
And they don't stop offering services at birth.
Absolutely not. I mean, they offer parenting classes. I mean, they're there to, you know, help women. They don't just kick them out the door. Maternity homes often will house the women after they give birth for several months, and we'll help them find adequate shelter afterwards. I mean, they don't just, you know, slap women when they're done and say you're done. You know, they are there to, you know, be there and be there for them, you know, not only during the pregnancy and birth, but afterwards.
Which kind of proves that the pro-life movement isn't just pro-birth, that they do care for people, babies and women, after the baby is born.
Absolutely. I mean, that's just, I think, a lazy slander the other side throws at us. You know, we are, you know, we don't necessarily support every last government program, you know, but we do care about women and children, and we want to help them and support them. And again, most of the money these pregnancy centers get are from donations. You know, they are from concerned citizens like you and me who, you know, generously support them. I'm on the board of the Northwest Center, which is a pro-life pregnancy center here in the D.C. area. And again, you know, we seek donations from people. Try to do our best to help women in need.
And you also, it's my understanding, you help women who've had abortions and may have emotional difficulties because of that. Is that right?
Sure. A lot of these centers have, you know, post-abortion healing. When I'm sidewalk counseling, I have brochures with Project Rachel, and that's something that's run by the Catholic Church, and they do, you know, healing retreats that are free of charge. Sometimes we do interact with people who face abortion regret, and, you know, we do have help available for them as well. So, you know, if there's any listeners out there who have had an abortion or been involved in the decision to have an abortion, help and healing are available. Can, you know, get the help, the support that you deserve and need. You know, don't be ashamed or embarrassed to seek God help. That people, we want to make you whole, and, you know, there are good programs like Project Rachel that are available.
Yeah, I've seen the signs that some women hold, "I regret my abortion."
Yep. No, I think that, you know, the Silent No More campaign has been recruiting testimonies from post-abortive women. I think they are some of the most powerful testimonies we have. I mean, not everyone who's had an abortion you know, feels comfortable with speaking publicly, that's fine. You know, people kind of have to heal and, you know, do things kind of on their own time and what they feel is kind of prudentially right. But women who do feel comfortable talk about that experience, that's very powerful. And I think that there's some of those powerful spokespeople that we have.
As we're recording this, the annual March for Life is approaching. Tell us a bit about the history of the march and what it seeks to accomplish now that Roe has been overturned.
Sure. The first March for Life was in January 22nd, 1974. It was on the first anniversary of the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision. And originally, it was just going to be a one-year event, you know, that, you know, the pro-life movement was very new. Prior to Roe v. Wade, it was largely a state issue. So, you know, the pro-life movement was not as organized as it is today. It was not really as well financed. You had some congressional staff who were interested. I don't think National Right to Life even opened up a D.C. office until the summer of 1973. So some local pro-lifers got together as a volunteer effort. So we need to do at least something to kind of remember this anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision. And from the media accounts of Red, about 5,000 people came, you know, which wasn't bad. And again, the original plan was to only do this for 1 year. And they took up a collection and people generously gave some money to help, you know, fund this event. And I think the group had a meeting and they had some extra money left over. And there's a discussion, what do you do with this extra money? And no one remembers who said this, but someone piped up, well, we put it toward next year's march. And the light bulb went on. Hey, this is a good idea. We should do this every year, which we have. And we've done the March for Life, you know, every year, either near or on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. And this year, the March for Life is going to be on January 23rd. 2026. So, you know, even after Dobbs, I still think the march is important for several reasons. First, I think we have to sadly remember the millions of lives lost to abortion because of Roe v. Wade. I also think that a large turnout in the March for Life shows very clearly that many people think that sanctity of life issues are important. It's a very clear signal to policymakers that the pro-life movement's here to stay. This is an important issue that we care about and we want to see some action on. And the federal government, you know, still, you know, can do a lot policy-wise to protect the preborn. But we want to see high demand protections, you know, put in place in the budget. We don't want our federal taxpayer dollars paying for abortion. We want the FDA to put some limits on chemical abortion. Congress still has the power, if they wanted to enact legal protections for preborn children. So there are things Congress can and should do. And a strong turnout, again, shows that this is an issue that matters to millions of Americans out there.
So this is political activism. About how many people turn out every year for the march?
That's a very good question. The National Park Service quit doing official counts a while ago because people would get mad and argue with them, and they just didn't want to deal with the people disagreeing with their estimates. It's in the hundreds of thousands. I'll be honest, I think numbers have gone down a little bit post-Dobbs, but many dioceses send large contingents. One thing I'm always love to see is the college students who come. Well, we have a couple conferences that Saturday after. Students Life of America does a big summit, which attracts over 1,000 students. The students at Georgetown host the Cardle O'Connor Conference on Life. That always is a good turnout on the Georgetown campus. So it's going to be, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people do come out for this.
As you observe, you're not a, you know, a youngster anymore. And I'm even older than you, obviously. But do you sense that younger people are attracted to the pro-life cause, or are they repelled by it? Obviously, it's both, but.
Well, obviously, young people, you know, are diverse views ideologically, but I would say compared to young people when I was in school, young people are a lot more interested in the pro-life issue than they were, you know, 30 years ago. You know, I mean, I'm ready to say it, the pro-life movement did not really make a big investment in youth outreach until Students Life of America came around in 2006, 2007. So it took us kind of 30 years after Roe v. Wade to properly fund a well-staffed professional kind of youth outreach movement. You know, again, I know that when I was in college, you know, if you were pro-life, for lack of a better word, it was just weird. It was a really odd position for somebody to have. Even in conservative political groups at Dartmouth, we had a lot of people who were not pro-life. Nowadays, you know, at least among right of center students politically, they're almost always pro-life. Very rarely when I meet like a college Republican or somebody involved in right of center politics on college campus who is not pro-life. So, you know, I think there's a lot more resources, a lot more, you know, activism, a lot more interest. So again, I always like seeing the young people. It reminds me that, you know, the cavalry is in fact coming up behind me.
You know, I remember, it may be apocryphal, but George Bush was asked, George W. Bush, if he supported a constitutional amendment that would outlaw abortion. And he said, no, even though he was pro-life. And the questioner said, well, why don't you? And he said, because if you could pass it, you wouldn't need it. In other words, it's really about the culture. Do you agree with that?
Yes and no. You know, I think that culture certainly is important. I mean, I think one of the reasons why we've not necessarily seen the big abortion declines post-Dobbs we hope we would see is that we won kind of the legal battle, but we haven't really won the cultural battle yet. So the culture is important. The law can affect culture. I should say that, you know, the culture can affect the law, but the law can affect culture too. So I think you have to fight this hand in hand. I don't think it's one or the other. I think it's both. I think that, you know, Roe v. Wade did change the culture in a way that made abortions more common. When abortion was legalized, it gained legitimacy. It gained credibility. You had abortion facilities and a financial interest in keeping abortion legal. I think it resulted in more sexual risk-taking that led to more abortions. I think it made it a lot easier for men to walk away from women they impregnated. That led to more abortions. So a more permissive policy on abortions did change the culture in such a way to make abortions even more common, even more regular. And similarly, you know, putting clamps on abortion could change the culture in some good ways too. You know, that people may, you know, be a bit more careful regarding their sexual activity. That if abortion is illegal, it does delegitimize, it does stigmatize. So culture can affect the law, but the law can affect culture too. I think we have to fight on both fronts.
I think the perhaps the biggest impediment to people going in your direction is people want ready access to sex, a lot of people. And I think that that's a powerful inducement to maintain the access to abortion.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, a promiscuous culture is never going to really embrace serious limits on abortion. You know, and it's tough because, I mean, people, you know, frankly, are getting married later these days. And, you know, there are a lot of, you know, people who are single, who are not in a kind of committed relationship, that would like to be sexually active. And that's an obstacle for us. You know, I don't deny that. I think that we do have to try and make the culture more chaste, more conservative sexually. That's an obstacle. It's a big one for us. It's not going to be easy, but I didn't sign up for this because I thought it'd be easy.
Well, we're just about out of time. If you had to predict, put on your head, your prediction hat, do you think that the country will ever become primarily pro-life, and how long do you think that will take?
The truth wins out in the end. I reminded the old statement which Winston Churchill once said, Americans always do the right thing after they try everything else. So I think that, you know, the truth will win out, and I think that people will realize that, you know, traditional values on sex and morality just make a lot of sense, and that, you know, the unborn children, you know, are precious and, you know, do deserve legal protection. You know, I also like another quote I'll give the audience. I like what Martin Luther King Jr. said. The arc of history is long, but does bend toward justice. And I think he was right when he said that. So I think you will someday see, you know, a world and a culture, both, you know, nationally and, you know, here in the U.S., you know, that does protect the preborn. I can't tell you when that's going to happen. You know, it probably will not happen largely probably until after I pass away. But I think progress has been made. Progress can be made. The one thing I always tell pro-life audiences is we did cut the abortion rate in half since 1980. We did make real progress. If the abortion rate today was what it was back in 1980, there'd be a million more abortions taking place every year. We're getting involved politically by funding pregnancy help centers. We save a million babies every year, and we spare a million women for a lifetime of regret. Progress can be made. I just don't know how quickly it's going to take, but it may take a while for us to win.
And it's really not about winning and losing as much as it is, from what I hear you saying, saving lives.
Absolutely. And saving souls.
That's another part, isn't it?
Yep.
So we're out of time, and I just want to ask, what's next for Michael J. New?
What's next? I'll be sidewalk casting the D.C. Planned Parenthood on Saturday. I will be at the March for Life this coming month. I will still be, you know, I blog on National Review Online. If your followers are on X or on Twitter, please give me a follow. I'm at Michael_J_New. You know, I have some other projects. I'm trying to get some articles in the peer-reviewed journals about, you know, the impacts of the new pro-life laws and the positive impact they're having. And I'm also working on a book project about how rhetoric on this issue has changed over time. You know, I think that the people who are pro-life are approaching the issue a little bit differently today than maybe we were 40 or 50 years ago. And I think chronicling our history is important. So I'll look for that coming out soon.
Well, thanks very much, Michael. And when that book comes out, let me know.
Absolutely.
All right. Take care.
God bless.
Thank you very much. Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.